KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining today on the program. Today I'm very excited to have on as a guest Professor Neil Natano, author of the book Copyright's Paradox from Oxford University Press. We've had a number of guests on the show discussing variations in copyright law, and we've also had guests on the show whose views of copyright law range from throwing the entire system out the window to strengthening the system that we currently have. In Copyright's Paradox, Neil takes a very deep and studied look at the tensions in copyright law, particularly, although it's certainly not the only one, but the main focus is the tension between copyright law and the First Amendment, that is, the right to free speech. Now, this is an area, of course, that is hotly contested throughout the world that deals with intellectual property. And it's not just an issue, of course, that gets most attention in the entertainment industry, but also we see it come up in issues involving the operation of search engines. We see this tension coming in derivative works and works that build upon the works of authors who may not want that particular derivative work, that particular extension or transformation of their work to exist in the first place. In Neil's book, he takes a very close study, starting with some very interesting stories that contextualize his larger discussion and argument about this paradox, this challenge within copyright law, and the tension between the First Amendment, what we colloquially know as the right to free speech, and copyright is present in copyright law in various iterations. And the history, indeed, of copyright law, which Neil also discusses, shows how this tension develops and where it might be. Now, it's oftentimes you read books that will discuss these issues, but don't spend a lot of time on solutions. Neil's book is not one of those. We're also going to get into his solution, which I don't even want to characterize at this point. I'm going to leave it to my guest to discuss that issue in more detail. But his solution also, I think, threads a number of different needles and ultimately respects the diverse interests that exist when a copyright is issued. Who has an interest in the copyright? Who shouldn't have an interest in the copyright? And how do we make sure that those interests are respected while still having an intellectual property system that operates from its basic conception of encouraging innovation? Neil's background he is a professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He writes and teaches in the areas of copyright, international intellectual property, and media and telecommunications. Neil, I'm very excited to have you on the show. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. Let's start right off with, I mentioned very briefly your background, but I often ask my authors, and I'll ask you, a little bit more about your background and why or how you came to focus on copyright law.
Yes. Well, it was actually somewhat happenstance. I never took copyright in law school. I graduated law school in 1980, and at that time, copyright was still a sort of somewhat esoteric backwater for most people, not like it is today, where it really touches upon so many people's lives so frequently. But I worked, coming out of law school, I worked for Loeb & Loeb, a Los Angeles law firm, in the litigation department, and it just so happened that we represented the, and I worked on the case, the manufacturer of Pac-Man video games in copyright infringement litigation. And that was my first taste of copyright. And I found the subject fascinating, and I've been involved in it ever since, for a number of years in practice and now for many years in academics as well.
Your background is also somewhat unusual in that you've practiced outside the United States. Perhaps you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes. After being at Loeb & Loeb for 3 years, I moved to Israel, and I practiced law in Israel for 8 years. Worked for one of Israel's, at that time, largest law firms, which was about 30 lawyers. Since then, law firms have grown significantly in Israel. My work was varied. I didn't only work in one particular field. I did do some copyright work. I was an advisor, actually, to a committee set up by Israel's Ministry of Justice to draft and enact a new copyright law for Israel. That effort just came to fruition, actually, last year. Israel finally enacted a new copyright revision.
Hmm.
And there I also represented Israel's first cable television company. So I was very much involved in telecommunications issues.
How does your perspective, having practiced in Israel and just ultimately having practiced law other than that of the United States, how has it informed your scholarship?
Well, I think, you know, like any sort of student of comparative law, I think being involved in other legal systems teaches you very basically that there are few fundamentals in law, that there are always other ways to do things, other ways to think about things, and I think that opens you up to questioning and wondering whether the legal system that you are currently involved with is really has the best solutions, or whether it might not be some better approaches.
The title of the book, Copyright's Paradox, we're going to get to in a moment, but I do want to touch on, as I was reading the book, you know, I always do start with the acknowledgments, although I suspect that a good many people may skip over them. But being in the field, I was interested to see that you challenge many major names in the intellectual property scholarly field, and you also thank many in your acknowledgments. And just, you know, as a reaction, I imagine it must have been an enormous amount of fun discussing these issues over the several years that you've spent putting together this book.
Oh, absolutely. I'm, you know, very fortunate to have wonderful colleagues, and not just colleagues. You know, I'm now involved in Los Angeles in an organization called the Los Angeles Copyright Society, which is an organization of leading copyright lawyers and entertainment lawyers in Los Angeles. And I disagree with many of their views, but, you know, it's a fascinating field and a rapidly growing dynamic field, and it's always been interesting to engage in debate and hear other people's viewpoints.
Let's start really at the very basic, and I'm actually going to ask an extremely basic question. I suspect that most listeners are familiar with what copyright is, but let me go a little bit step further and not ask you exactly what a copyright is in its basic definition, but perhaps ask the question a little bit differently in a contextualized discussion. What bundle of rights generally does an author derive at the core level when they get a copyright?
Yes, well, you put it quite rightly, there is a bundle of rights that today make up the copyright. First, there's exclusive right to reproduce copies, but that right actually has, you know, very importantly, you know, for many years been interpreted and defined to be far more than a right to make literal copies, but even works that are non-literal copies that draw upon sort of the basic themes and plot of the original also are viewed as a copy for the purpose of copyright law, and the author may often prevent others from copying in that way without the author's permission. Copyright law also gives the author what's now called the exclusive right to prepare derivative works. Derivative works are translations, abridgments, motion picture versions of novels, dramatizations, sequels. It's really a very, very broad right that encompasses various variations on the original. Authors also have the exclusive right to publicly perform the work. Public performance is not just live performance. It also includes broadcasting over the radio, over the television. It also includes streaming over the Internet, webcasting, and the like. And then finally, the author also has the exclusive right to distribute copies to the public, and then finally the right of public display, which includes both live display and also posting graphics on an internet web page and the like.
The corollary question, I'm not going to ask a question of what can't the author do, but when we think about copyright, we do see some situations, and certainly they get press, where the public perception may be that a holder of a copyright can't do what they purport to be able to do or have attempted to do. And I guess my question leads to this follow-up. Based upon your research, and obviously you've spoken to a lot of people, do you have a sense of how the authors themselves, the people that are actually creating the works and getting the copyrights, understand the rights that they get? What's your sense of the creator's view of what they can do once they get a copyright?
Yeah, I think that is a great question, but I think it's a very difficult question to answer because,
sure.
You know, authors are as varied as the population in general, I think. There are authors who are professional Hollywood screenwriters, a member of a guild, and probably have a very good understanding of exactly what rights they have and what rights they don't have. Whereas other authors, perhaps a visual artist, a painter, might have very little understanding. And I think authors also have very different expectations about the nature of their right. Some authors, you know, tend to see their work in very much instrumental terms. They create works either just purely to make some money, or they want to get their message out. They don't expect to have absolute control over their work. They're not bothered if someone else should take their work and change it or quote from them. Other authors very much feel towards their work as if the work is an extension of their personality and take it very personally. If someone misquotes their work or uses their work in a context which they feel doesn't comport with their understanding of what the work's message is.
And it's a fair point that we don't have a monolithic author floating out there. And I think that variation actually gets us to discuss the book, at least initially, by discussing its title. So what do you mean by the title, Copyrights Paradox?
The Supreme Court has referred to copyright as the engine of free expression, which means that, and I take that moniker quite seriously, which means that copyright, for various reasons and in various ways, provides a vital economic incentive for the creation and distribution of much of the literature, commentary, music, art, and film that makes up our public discourse. Really provides a lot of support for our system of free expression. But at the same time, and on the other hand, copyright also burdens speech. So I may need or want to copy or build upon your copyrighted expression in order to most effectively convey my message. And because of copyright law, I might not be able to do that.
The nature of the copyright itself at that point does come into some tension, because you refer to this issue as a paradox. And I guess I'll ask you a little more detail. From what perspective or perspectives do we have a paradox?
Well, I think it's, from my perspective, copyright has from its inception been closely aligned with the First Amendment. The Copyright Clause of the Constitution gives Congress the authority to enact a copyright law for a reason, right? It says in order to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. The word science, particularly at that time, was meant in a broader sense, meaning to promote learning, to promote education. The founders saw copyright and the promotion of education as fundamental to a free republic and a free constitution. You see this very interesting language to that effect when President Washington introduced the first copyright law to Congress in 1790. I think copyright, and I argue in the book, that copyright shares many of the goals of the First Amendment. But from the First Amendment perspective today, copyright has, particularly today, copyright has become so broad, extends to so many uses of the work, that just as copyright shares some of the goals of the First Amendment and promotes the production of new expression and expressive diversity. Copyright also burdened speech in many ways.
Your book covers a wide variety of law, both First Amendment jurisprudence as well as copyright jurisprudence. What would you say is the thesis of the book?
Well, I think that copyright law must be seen as an inherent part of media, information, and telecommunications law policy, the policies that are informed by the First Amendment. And I should clarify here that when I talk about the tension between, or the paradox arising between copyright and the First Amendment, I don't refer simply to First Amendment doctrine. So in other words, the copyright can come into conflict with what's commonly called free speech policy or First Amendment policy, the values behind the First Amendment, even if the First Amendment in a particular case wouldn't trump the exercise of copyright. So basically, my thesis is that First Amendment values, the interest in expressive diversity, should be the guiding lodestar in calibrating and tailoring the scope and extent of copyright.
We're going to be chatting about fair use later in the show, and in fact, I want to ask you a couple of questions about the fair use doctrine, obviously a doctrine that's intertwined, although not an identical to the First Amendment for copyright purposes. But let's get into, and I mentioned in the introduction, you discuss a number of forces acting on copyright doctrine, different interests or entities, or just actors that are impacting copyright law today. What entities are those, and do you have an opinion on who or which ones might have the most influence on the direction of the law currently?
Yes. Well, let me, if I may, first say something about the direction of the law.
Sure.
Because I think that's important to understand initially, at least. Talking about what are the entities that have influenced the law. Copyright law, that bundle of rights that we talked about earlier that make up copyright, have expanded dramatically over the years, certainly since copyright's inception, but also even within the last half a century and a couple of decades. Just to give two quick examples, the duration of copyright. Initially, under the 1790 Copyright Act, the first Copyright Act, copyright lasted for a maximum of 28 years. It couldn't last for any, it might have lasted for various reasons for less than that, but for at most 28 years. As late as 1976, or the effective date of the 1976 Copyright Act, the vast majority of published works only enjoyed copyright protection for 28 years.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the standard term of protection is the life of the author plus 70 years. So many works, the copyright is going to last for well over a century. And then also, so that's the length of copyright, there's also the scope of copyright. The derivative right we talked about earlier, the sense that the rule that copyright encompasses not just literal copies, but also non-literal copies. So there's a case, which I talk about in my book, in the mid-19th century, in which somebody translated Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin into German.
Mm-hmm.
And Stowe sued for copyright infringement, and the court in this case, in line with then prevailing copyright doctrine, held that this was not a copyright infringement. The judge threw Harriet Beecher Stowe out of court, said, well, your copyright extends to the right to make copies of your work, doesn't extend to the right to make translations. A translation is a separate work. It requires separate, independent creativity and thought, and you don't have control over that. Anyone who wants to can translate your work. Today, of course, that is no longer the case. Congress amended the Copyright Act in the late 19th century to provide an exclusive right to make translations. With today's derivative work, the copyright owner's rights extend far, far beyond, right? Even very minimal copying from the work it can now be included in the copyright owner's exclusive rights. So when we look at the changes in copyright law, we see a fairly steady progression towards expanding the scope and length of copyright holder rights. So that's the preface to your question that you asked, sort of, what are the forces? Why has that happened? And why might that continue to be happening? I think there are a number of reasons. First and foremost, there has been considerable, continuous, and quite concerted lobbying by the major copyright industries. The motion picture studios, the book publishers, the record labels, those have an interest in expanding copyrights, lobby Congress, and have considerable cachet in Congress, given the visibility of Hollywood, and have been quite successful in obtaining various enactments that lengthen and expand the scope of copyrights. I think there's also a sense among many judges that copyright is some kind of a natural right, that it's it's seen as a broad property right, as something which it's stealing for someone, not just to pirate a work, to copy the work word for word, but even to build upon a work in creating a new work. And that conception has also been promoted by the entertainment industry, but was not the original conception of copyright. The Supreme Court still refers to copyright as a limited monopoly designed for a very specific purpose, to provide an incentive for the creation of new work, and an exclusive right that shouldn't go beyond what's necessary to provide that incentive. But I think particularly many lower courts don't see it that way, and in some of the decisions, they provide quite broad protection for copyright. So I think those are two forces today which have promoted the expansion of copyright. Although I think particularly with digital technology and the emergence of high technology industries in Silicon Valley as a major economic force in the United States, there in recent years has been some considerable pushback. And today, not in all cases, but in many cases, we see telecommunications companies like Google, which are standing up to the traditional copyright incumbents and at least trying to carve out some exceptions that suit their needs, and make the case on behalf of many of the public who are now more and more concerned that copyright has just become too broad, too overextensive, too intrusive, and argue that there's got to be some limit to this growth of copyright.
We're talking with Professor Neil Nathanael, author of the book Copyright's Paradox, here on Hearsay Culture, KZSU-FM Stanford. Neil, in contextualizing our discussion and getting into some of the details of this paradox, this tension that is the theme of your book, you use a number of examples in the beginning of the book to, I think, contextualize the discussion and to really put meat on the bones of the story. And one story that jumped out at me was your story regarding the late Senator Cranston. So perhaps you could tell listeners about that story and how it fits into our larger discussion and the thesis of your book.
Yes. So as many listeners may know, Alan Cranston was a prominent United States senator from California for about 25 years, spanning from the 1960s to the 1990s. But decades earlier, in the late 1930s, Cranston was a young journalist working for the International News Service in Europe. Cranston spoke German fluently. He had read Hitler's Mein Kampf and was obviously horrified by what he had read. But when the official English translation came out, by this time Cranston had returned to the United States, he read that too, and he was doubly horrified because the official translation was a whitewash. Key passages had been deleted to make the work more palatable for American readers. Cranston responded to this by producing an unauthorized critical translation of Hitler's political blueprint. Cranston's translation was accompanied by critical commentary, and he put back in and focused on the key passages that had been omitted, and that revealed Hitler's true character and intentions. Cranston's book pled etched on the cover in large red letters, not one cent of royalty to Hitler, and it promised that any profits would go to help refugees from the Nazi Reich. Cranston's 32-page book was priced at only 10 cents a copy and sold a half a million copies in 10 days. But then, Houghton Mifflin, the U.S. publisher of Hitler's authorized translation, sued Cranston and his publisher for copyright infringement, and upon Houghton Mifflin's motion, the court enjoined further publication of Cranston's avowedly anti-Hitler translation. So, the end result of this is that in 1939, at the eve of World War II, when the United States public and government really had to make quite monumental decisions about the position of the United States regarding the Nazi regime and the hostilities in Europe, the public was deprived of the opportunity of getting access and reading this critical translation of Mein Kampf.
We're talking to Professor Neil Nathanael, author of the book Copyright's Paradox, here on Hearsay Culture. And Neil, we're going to take a quick break. The quick break on Hearsay Culture is always and uniformly to remind you that KZSU is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the webpage, excuse me, and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, I do hope that you continue to listen to Hearsay Culture. So with that very brief break and that story, which really is quite alarming on a number of levels, and copyright's one of them, certainly the publication of Hitler's work in that manner by Houghton Mifflin is disturbing in its own right. What I find interesting about that story, Neil, perhaps you could connect this, is that of course we're talking about activity that occurred, yeah, 60-odd years ago, over 60 years ago, close to 70 years ago. And it seems like we're talking about the same problems today, are we not?
I think very much so, yes. To the extent that, and this is a key point, so Cranston's defense would be fair use. His purpose was critical to criticize the original work. He was obviously making a very important public statement. But then, as today, fair use doctrine is probably inadequate to deal with this. And I think, if anything, there was for a long time a constriction of the fair use doctrine. And one of the points I make in my book is that fair use has got to be tied in with First Amendment values and interpreted in such a way to allow this kind of speech.
And I think this is a good time to start getting into the fair use doctrine as we discuss these issues. And perhaps I'll ask you this background question, which gets to what the fair use doctrine is. But with regard to this intersection of copyright and the First Amendment, you make the point, and you've made today in the interview, and you make this point strongly in the book, that both of those doctrines share the mutual goal of promoting creation, but not just that. You talk about the spread of information, that the First Amendment and copyright both encourage the spread of information. And I think for those that think about copyright as a restrictive doctrine, they may be surprised to hear you make that point. So perhaps you could explain that, and I think certainly tie it, it does tie in to our discussion of fair use.
Yes. Yeah, in order for the copyright incentive to have the desired effect, which is to promote education, to promote learning, to promote the dissemination of cultural and political expression, authors' original works have got to be not only created but also distributed to the public. I think it's important to keep in mind, it wasn't too much long ago, we didn't have an internet.
Right.
And the way that works, the only way works could be disseminated was through analog, through hard copy, either by broadcasters or by distributing multiple copies over great distances. And in that era, it took a considerable capital investment to develop distribution networks, to produce the copies, and to make the works available to the public. And to a very large extent, copyrights, the exclusive right to make copies and distribute copies to the public, is a right designed to give publishers an incentive to invest in that activity, to buy licenses from authors, to distribute the works to the public. Not just an incentive to authors in the first instance to create the work. Today, though, that's one of the challenges of copyright today. Today, with digital technology and the Internet, where once a work is created, it can be put up on a web page, disseminated on the Internet for virtually no cost. That rationale for copyright is much reduced and much changed.
Another example you use in contextualizing discussion is the situation that the journalist Declan McCulloch, who also will be on Hearsay Culture, I should note, later in the year or perhaps early next year, faced with regard to some information that he received in his role as a journalist. And tell us that story and how that ties in.
Right. Well, Declan McCulloch's issue has to do with a 1998 amendment to the Copyright Act called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or commonly referred to by its initials, the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The DMCA forbids circumventing technological protection measures that are imposed on works, for example, encryption. Right, so digital encryption, works can be digitally encrypted to effectively control access to copyrighted material. The entertainment industries argued to Congress that in the digital era, unless they can use digital rights management, DRM, or technological protection measures to encrypt their works and physically control access and copying the works, they are never going to be able to prevent full-scale, massive piracy, right, copying of their works, and that will completely undermine the copyright incentive and undermine their valuable property rights. So Congress enacted the DMCA, but what's happened is that in many instances the DMCA cast a web which is really far too wide. Declan McCulloch is a reporter for CNET News. He was researching a story on airport security measures, and he came upon four documents on the Transportation Security Administration website that, according to a brief description on the website, covered airport security procedures, the relationship between federal and local police, and a liability information sheet. The documents were encrypted. The website permitted McCulloch to download the files, but required a password to open and read them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a confidential source gave McCulloch, right, a journalist, what he believed to be the correct secret password to the documents. And like any journalist worth his salt, his first impulse must have been to enter the password, to read the documents, and to report on their newsworthy contents. Right? This was vital information involving airport security. Certainly, that has been the soul of investigative news gathering since long before the New York Times published the Pentagon Papers. But McCulloch, who often reports on technology and IP issues, feared that because he was using this purloined password to de-encrypt the document, he could face civil and criminal liability under the DMCA. He was, after all, circumventing a technological protection measure without the authority of the copyright owner. And he chose the better part of valor. He declined to use the password, and therefore did not report on the contents.
This particular story, of course, raises the question: is this what we envision is supposed to be embodied in the operation of copyright law? That a journalist would be unable for fear of violating the DMCA or a copyright statute generally, would fear violating such a statute by, as you say, doing their job?
Certainly not. Absolutely not. I think this is an instance in which copyright law has, as it has expanded by now by this addition to the DMCA, comes into direct conflict with its initial and fundamental goal, which is in line with the First Amendment, to disseminate expression, to educate the public, to enhance learning. And let me say, the fair use provision, now we're sort of getting back to fair use, it is designed, at least in part, to allow for copying for purposes of news reporting. News reporting is one of the favored uses, which is actually referred to in the Copyright Act in the fair use provision. However, the DMCA does not include any fair use exception for circumvention. So Declan McCullough could not rely on fair use as a defense to his violation of the DMCA.
When we discuss the fair use doctrine, I've asked this question of a few guests, and I want to get your opinion. I've had some guests say to me that the fair use doctrine is not part of copyright law, that it's a defense to a copyright violation. Now, lawyers, may see a distinction there, but from our broader view, what do you make of that argument? In other words, is it accurate in any way to suggest that the fair use doctrine simply isn't part of copyright doctrine, but rather a defense to violation of copyright?
Yeah, I fundamentally disagree with that proposition. There is a theory of fair use that says fair use should be an anomalous, rare exception to the copyright, should only be available when there's complete market failure, right? When the copyright owner and the user could not possibly come to terms for a copyright license because of high transaction costs. And I absolutely do not see it that way. To my mind, and to the mind of other commentators, and I think fortunately many courts as well, fair use is no less central to copyright doctrine than to granting to the copyright holder the rights in the first place. Copyright has got to be balanced. It has to be narrowly tailored to provide this incentive. Copyright has got to be drafted and conceived in line with its fundamental goals, which are tied into free speech values. And without fair use, copyright isn't serving its purpose.
We're talking with Professor Neil Natano, author of the book Copyright's Paradox. And Neil, we have about 15 minutes left in our discussion. And I do want to talk more specifically from, perhaps from almost a natural rights perspective or a personhood perspective about the role of the author. And there is a reemergence of interest in the argument that authors should be able to control their work more strongly than they can do today under current law, especially with the fair use doctrine, because in essence their created work is an extension of themselves, what we like to think of as a personhood argument with respect to copyright. What do you make of that argument, and how much of that argument or that theory do you think is currently contained in copyright law?
Well, yeah, that theory is closely aligned with a doctrine called the Doctrine of Moral Rights, a translation of droit moral, which comes from continental copyright. Under continental the laws of various European countries, authors have a non-economic right, a personal right, to prevent distortions in their work, to control the way and manner of their work and timing in which their work is presented to the public. It includes the right of authorship attribution as well as the right to prevent changes in the work. That the moral rights are actually not a feature, except in a very, very limited extent, of U.S. copyright law, and have not really been a part of the traditional philosophy of U.S. copyright law. U.S. copyright law has traditionally been understood as more of an economic incentive to benefit the authors to create works which are good for the public, and that's why we give authors a reward. It's not because of some natural right. At the same same time, as you point out, there is this this sense, certainly among many authors and others, that there should be this natural right, and that authors do have this connection to their work, and should have control over, even non-economic control, aside from the right to receive compensation, the right to control the way their work is presented. So one example might be John Densmore, former member of the Doors, insists, contrary to the other former members of the band, that the Doors' music should not be used for any commercials. He cares very deeply about that. And even if the other members of the band are able to give an economic license, a copyright license, he feels that this work is an extension of him, and he doesn't want to see it used in a context with which he doesn't agree. My view on this is, firstly, I fully sympathize and empathize and understand that feeling. I think many, but certainly not all authors, do feel that deep emotional attachment to their work, and they don't want their work used in the service of something with which they don't believe. At the same time, though, we need to balance that concern, that desire, with free speech interests. Adolf Hitler might have felt the same way about his work and his translation. He doesn't want Alan Cranston translating in a way which he feels casts his views in false light, or in a light in which he doesn't want to be presented. So I think, once the author has created the work and made it available to the public, from that point on, others should be free to use the work in a way to criticize the work and to be freer to use the work in other ways, so long as, I think this is very important, and I argue this in my book, so long as the public isn't misled to think that the author is endorsing the user's point of view. So, for example, I think if someone wants to use a work on the internet to put it in a different context, or to adapt it, to take from the work and put it into their own work, they need to make very clear by labeling, perhaps with a link to the original work, and make clear that this is their point of view and not the original author's point of view.
In the remaining 10 minutes or so that we have on the show, I do want to talk a little bit about issues involving preservation and archival activity. And we've seen, of course, the Google Book Search efforts and the Internet Archive and others that are attempting to literally preserve the printed word through modern digital mass storage means. But we also see this issue come up certainly with a lot less attention in the issue of recorded sound preservation. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about the impact of copyright law on preservation, and then to the extent that you've taken a look at it. I know there was, a recent decision involving Yoko Ono, and the disclaimer I should mention is that the Center for Internet Society at Stanford represented actually the defendants in that case. I was not personally involved in the case, however. But we could discuss the recent decision involving Yoko Ono and EMI's concerns about the use of the song Imagine in Ben Stein's movie. But more broadly than that, what about preservation? How does copyright law impact the ability of archives to preserve recorded sound?
Yes. Well, entertainment industries, particularly the motion picture industries, in lobbying Congress for an extension of the copyright term, Congress, what was called the Sony-Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, Congress lengthened the copyright term, added another 20 years. So what, at the time it was life plus the author plus 50 years, it's now life the author plus 70 years. And part of the argument was, well, we need this, we need copyright to give us an incentive to preserve works. It takes a considerable investment of time and money to preserve old films, old sound recordings, old texts, unless we have an exclusive right, these works are just going to be orphans. No one's going to care about them. And they'll just fall into disuse and disrepair. Ironically, though, right, if you look at what has happened over the last couple decades, the entities that have been the primary forces for archiving and preserving old works have actually not been the copyright industries, but rather nonprofit archives. And more recently, Google Books, right, which is seeking to preserve and create a vast database of printed material without actually charging for its use, but hopes to be able to indirectly benefit from advertising from that. But if anything, copyright has been an obstacle to that archive activity. So nonprofit internet archivists only will scan and preserve works that were published prior to 1923 in the United States, because only works published prior to 1923, you can know for certain, are no longer protected by copyright. They won't touch works that were created after that time because of a fear, firstly, a fear of being sued for copyright infringement, and secondly, because it just costs too much to find the owner of the copyright, to negotiate for a license. Certainly, if it's a nonprofit archive, it doesn't have the funds to engage in that activity and to pay for a license. And the same is true with Google. Google Books. Google plans to scan and put into its archive, its digital database, and make available at least portions of the works for view through its internet search engine. Millions of books. It would extend the resources even of Google to have to negotiate for and find who the owners of old books are. To clear the licenses for that activity. And, of course, Google Books is now being sued for copyright infringement.
Right.
I think, ironically, copyright, rather than being a spur to greater preservation, has come to be an obstacle to digital preservation.
I often have to do this to authors, especially authors that cover a wide variety of ground in a book like yours. And so we have about 5 minutes left, and of course I'm going to ask you a question that could take easily an hour to discuss. But this is radio, and I am limited in my way by the temporal range of time. What is your solution to these problems, in a nutshell? How would you propose going about dealing with the many tensions and paradoxes that we discussed today?
Yes, I do not think there is a single. Well, we have at least 5 minutes because I totally could not give a solution in a 2 second or 10 second soundbite.
Right.
But I think on a number of, there are a number of possible solutions. First of all, let me say that. I think during our discussion today, I've been largely critical of copyright, but I am certainly not in favor of abolishing copyright. I do think that even in the digital arena, even in the internet age where there's a plethora of expression available that doesn't require copyright and the authors haven't relied on copyright to create it, I do think we would still lose a lot were we not to have the copyright incentive. Because I do think that copyright still provides a very important incentive for creating lots of works that are quite valuable. Documentary films, full-length motion pictures, many books, many musical compositions, lots and lots of kind of works. We would have far less of them created and probably less good ones created were we not to to have the copyright incentive. So my proposals are in the nature of tailoring copyright to still make certain that copyright owners and authors receive remuneration for the use of their work, but to take away some of the veto power that a property right gives them over expression that they either would not want to license or would license at such a high cost that it would make it prohibitively expensive. So on a number of fronts, first of all, I would strengthen fair use. Today, the burden of proving that a use is fair falls on the user, the defendants, rather than the burden falling on the plaintiff to prove that the use is not fair, I think properly viewed and understood as a free speech safeguard as it is, so I think fair use doctrine should shift the burden, and the burden shouldn't be on the speaker to prove the exception, but rather the burden should be on the copyright owner to prove that the fair use test has not been met. Secondly, I think, and the Supreme Court has actually suggested this should be the case, but for various reasons, lower courts have not taken up the challenge, that where there is a colorable claim of fair use, but the court still finds it's not a fair use, the court should be free to craft a compulsory license, basically, to say, the defendant has to pay something for the use of his work, pay some kind of reasonable license fee, but doesn't have to get the permission of the author to make the use. And there's some technical reasons I discuss in the book why the copyright statute would have to be amended to allow for that flexibility. I also think that in many areas, and this is a topic we really haven't touched upon much today, that in much of the copyright tension and paradox is not so much between an individual author and an individual speaker or user, but rather between industries. And copyright is often used by incumbent industries as a restraint against competition from new media. Oftentimes, new media requires, in order to get off the ground, to reach an audience, to distribute or allow for the distribution of popular expression, as well as new expression. And traditionally, when that's happened, the Congress has often, not always, but often, provided for a compulsory license in that context as well. So, for example, cable television. Cable television operators are allowed to transmit in real time over-the-air broadcasts without having to get the permission of the copyright owner, so long as they pay a statutory fee. Webcasters are allowed to transmit sound recordings over the Internet, so long as they pay a statutory fee. They don't have to negotiate a license from the copyright owner. And one of the reasons for that statutory scheme is the fear that the copyright industries will see these new incumbents as competitive threats to their distribution arms, and won't grant licenses in order to thwart competition, and in doing so will counter and stifle expressive diversity. So I favor, in other instances that I discuss in my book, a greater use and acceptance of compulsory licensing to enable copyright owners and authors to receive compensation, but to take away that veto power over new media.
The author is Professor Neil Natano. The book is Copyright's Paradox from Oxford University Press. Neil, it's obviously a fascinating area. This is probably one of the most unfair questions I could ask you, especially since literally we're looking at about 30 seconds. But are your solutions fairly called a compromise between what we colloquially know as the copy left and copyright maximalists on the other side?
In a way, yes. I think copyleft is somewhat of a misnomer because many people on copyleft want to use copyright as a way of allowing greater access to their work. But, yeah, I think certainly I try to carve out a compromise between what I call digital anarchy and digital lockup. So I think that is a fair characterization.
Neil, for those people that want to learn more about your work, obviously we have your book. Where else can they turn?
I list my publications on my website, so if you go to the UCLA Law School website and find my webpage there, you can find a list of my previous publications as well as my forthcoming description, some description of my forthcoming work.
Which, very quickly, the topic?
Two primary pieces. Mm-hmm. One is I'm editing a work on intellectual property and developing countries. It's a book coming out called The Development Agenda, Global Intellectual Property in Developing Countries. And then I'm also working on a project very different from this one involving Jewish copyright law, which is called From Maimonides to Microsoft, the Jewish Law of Copyright Since the Birth of Print.
Neil Nathaniel, professor at UCLA School of Law, thank you for joining me today on the show. I certainly invite you back to discuss copyright as well as to discuss both of those works, which sound fascinating. I look forward to reading.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. We've been talking with Professor Neil Nathaniel, author of the book Copyright's Paradox from Oxford University Press. As always, there are many ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can go to hearsayculture.com and pick up all of the shows heretofore, over 70 at this point. You can also find the schedule of upcoming guests. You can listen to the show, of course, the standard way, the old-fashioned way, as it were, by tuning your radio to 90.1 FM if you're living in the Bay Area. I do hope you listen to KZSU, and you can pick up the show streaming live outside the Bay Area at 5 o'clock Pacific time on Wednesdays by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can get the show through the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, as well as CIS's homepage, which is cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Also, as always, I welcome your feedback and suggestions and comments by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thanks again for listening to Hearsay Culture today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you actually after the interim period at the end of September. Take care. Bye-bye.